You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rockland, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle-Rockland, and I am here to help you break free from body shame, diets, and binging. And diets that don't work, by the way. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. And if you would like to join me today, if you have any questions for me, please feel free to call. The call-in number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Josh is asking, can you talk about the difference between disciplined eating, fasting, and anorexia? Well, I don't know what disciplined eating is. I think that depends on different people have a different idea of what disciplined eating is. Fasting is when you don't eat. And anorexia is when you have a fear of a terrible fear of gaining weight. There's a lot of different features of anorexia, but anorexia is when you're starving yourself to get thinner, because on some level you think that if you are thinner, you will have a better life. There's a lot of body dysmorphia in anorexia, and anorexia is a serious mental disorder that causes incredible psychological pain. Fasting and disciplined eating are really having to do with just your relationship with food. Anorexia involves fasting often and disciplined eating, but really it is the motivation behind the behavior that is the most important. Hopefully that makes sense. And Josh, if you have any other questions, feel free to keep dropping them. He's on Instagram. So if you're on Instagram, just drop a comment or a question if you want me to cover anything. So a couple of weeks ago, I talked about quote unquote food addiction, and I've gotten some emails and DMs asking me to expand on that. So I'm actually going to read a little bit from my book, Beyond the Primal Addiction. I co-edited it with my mentor, the amazing Salman Akhtar. I did a chapter on food addiction. So this is from that chapter. Let me give you just an example. Let me tell you about Ruth, not her real name. So Ruth considered herself a food addict. She felt discouraged by her lack of control over food at night. She was single, she had never been married, and she was relatively new to the Los Angeles area. She had not formed any meaningful relationships in the area, nor was she dating. She thought nobody would be attracted to her at her current weight. Ruth made healthy choices at breakfast and lunch pretty easily. Wasn't hard to do at all. Only at night, when she was home by herself, did food become a problem. She described how in those dark hours, an emptiness came upon her, slowly expanding until it was an unbearable void. When we explored that internal void, she spoke of a childhood marked by desperate loneliness. And I had the sense, as she spoke, of her being enveloped by forlornness, just really empty. But Ruth was not interested in talking about the past. From her perspective, the problem was in the here and now. The problem was why she couldn't stay out of the kitchen at night. That was the problem too. I believe that her relationship to food was expressing something that her mind could not process, could not tolerate. When Ruth was alone at night, she felt the echoes of that childhood loneliness. She felt the echoes of that emptiness. By stuffing herself until she was full, she symbolically filled that emotional void with food. Unconsciously, and this is important, unconsciously swapping emotional emptiness for a full stomach. Instead of feeling emotionally uncomfortable and empty, she experienced only the physical sensation of discomfort. So Ruth had been focused on what she was eating instead of identifying and processing what was eating at her. The problem was not food. The problem was her intense emotional hunger. So when I explained this and we went over it, she looked sort of dazed and also relieved. She couldn't believe it. She said, "So I'm not a food addict?" She sighed in relief. She said, "All this time I thought there was something wrong with my brain that made me eat." Now, what she said was very important, something wrong with her brain, because here's the thing. We have brains and we also have minds. So, you know, people who binge often believe, as Ruth did, as maybe you do, that food is the problem. They describe themselves as chocoholics or foodaholics. They think they're always going to struggle with this quote unquote addiction to food. Many of them never touch white flour or sugar. They think the only way to stay quote unquote clean is to avoid all problematic or forbidden food. So inevitably, because as we know, deprivation leads to binging, inevitably they binge or overeat on the foods that they deprive themselves of, then experiencing intense feelings of shame and labeling themselves as hopeless addicts. So is food addiction a valid concept? Short answer, no. Long answer. So in the last years, there's been a lot of media coverage about this. A few years ago, I posted something on Facebook, and it was respect to that when it comes to binge eating, psychological triggers are much more influential on us than food. Well, this didn't go over with some people. Quote, a proven fact that sugar is as addictive as heroin. And this person is not alone in her belief that sugar and heroin are equivalent. Lately, it seems that the idea of food addiction, especially sugar addiction, is accepted by the general public. We all take it for granted. Yeah, sure, food addiction, it's a thing. But actually, it's not. So all this time that we spend time and money detoxing from sugar, well, this notion of detoxification is also false, since any food eaten, by the way, any food eaten, even pure protein, can be turned into sugar in the body through the process of gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis is a metabolic pathway that results in glucose being generated from non-carbohydrate foods. How about that? Even if you eat not a single carb all day, your body is still going to produce carbs. So there are books that say, look, sugar is not only addictive, but is the principal cause of obesity, diabetes, coronary heart disease, many other fatal diseases. They say sugar is poisoning us, making us obese and unhealthy. But studies from the fields of neurology and obesity research, they've actually come to some very different conclusions. Some researchers believe that food can be in some ways considered addictive. And these studies make a case for the reward theory of food addiction. They quote dopamine levels. So dopamine is a chemical that mediates pleasure and motivation in our brains. Okay, brains, not minds. So the basic theory of food addiction is that sugar and other foods activate the release of dopamine. People eat sugar, they get that dopamine rush, they feel good, and then they have to have increasing amounts to get the same experience they previously felt with less. Food addiction theory points to changes in the brain's especially higher levels of dopamine as evidence of addiction. However, sounds good, right? Not so fast. a ton of other studies refute these claims. There is little evidence to support the idea of any food as physiologically addictive, including sugar, which is the substance most often labeled as addictive. A nutrition researcher and neurobiologist, Stéphane Guyanet, I'm butchering his name, I'm sure, reminds us that diet and lifestyle factors such as excess calorie intake, physical inactivity, cigarette smoking, alcohol, drug use contribute to obesity and other diseases. And he further notes, and this is important, he further notes that these diseases are not all correlated with sugar intake. And he points out that sugar intake has actually been declining in the last couple of decades, the same period in which both obesity and diabetes rates have dramatically increased. So pretty interesting, right? Now, make no mistake, sugar does change our brains, as do as having sex, shopping, any other pleasurable activity also raises our dopamine levels. One study proved that listening to classical music has the same impact on our brains as cocaine. Our brains also react differently to sugar than to drugs like cocaine or heroin. In research studies with rodents who were given cocaine, their dopamine levels surged, but they did not return to baseline. So this is not what happens with sugar or any other so-called addictive foods. After ingesting sugar, dopamine levels surge, but then they return to baseline and they stay consistent. So this is all brain stuff. Also, studies that say, oh, rats are more interested in sugar than heroin, that is very misleading, as heard by survival. Heroin and cocaine does not help a rat survive. Maybe get happy, but not survive. So when given a choice between a drug and a food like sugar, guess what? Those rats are going to choose sugar every time. They are motivated by survival, not by getting high. That's why they choose sugar over heroin. In many of those studies, not all of them, but many of those studies, those rats were starved before they were given the choice between sugar or heroin, which kind of skews the results, right? Oh, they went straight for the sugar. So just keeping that in mind. So there is little evidence to support sugar addiction in humans. I'm talking about the brain stuff. Of course, you feel addicted, right? Make no mistake, we can feel addicted. But since I was talking about the difference between our brains and our minds, let's stay with our brains first. Our brains do not become physiologically addicted to sugar. And I can go into a bunch of more study stuff, but I'm going to skip that. If you feel like a sugar addict, it doesn't matter what the science says, but that has to do with our psychology and our minds. So as the case was for Ruth, she was using food as a way of coping with painful feelings from the past that she experienced in the present. And that had to do with her mind, not her brain, but trying to helping her. And what do you think happened with Ruth? Well, I'll tell you, when she was able to make new friends, start filling up on, relationships, having fulfilling, satisfying, gratifying, all words we use with food as well, relationships with friends. Josh, I'll be right there. She was able to stop using food to symbolically fill the void. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Dr. Nina. I wrote some things in Instagram, and I wanted to talk to you about them. I think I said something like the relationship between our food behaviors and our parents, and maybe how that's sort of part of why we would be having issues with food, because it has to do with a relationship with a parent.
Well, there is no our, there's just you. There's just absolutely right. But again, it has to do with a person's individual experience. As an example, I had a patient, I write about this in my Food for Thought book. She started gaining, she was a normal weight, even a little underweight. And she started eating and eating and eating and eating. And she had a big fight with her mother right beforehand. And she started eating and eating and eating. She felt very distanced from her mother. And I noticed that everything she ate had 135 calories. She's like, oh, I had like 10 cookies and they were all 135 calories. And she was always making reference to the number 135. And she had a terrible relationship with her mom. And I asked her, how much does your mother weigh? What do you think she said?
135.
So we uncovered this unconscious, this is extreme, of course. This is not everyone. This is just, to my point, it's an individual thing. She was trying to gain the weight of her mother. She said, I'm not going to stop. Well, this is important. I forgot to say this. She said, I'm not going to stop gaining weight until I gain like 135 pounds. I think that's when I'll stop. So we realized that in gaining 135 pounds, she would sort of symbolically be wearing her mother on her body. And therefore they could never be separated because she would feel that her mother was with her. She would binge on things that she didn't like peanut butter, but her mother loved. So you're absolutely right in that unresolved relationships with parents, siblings, others with whom we have a strong relationship can definitely affect our relationship with ourselves and with him example, but everyone is different. How do you think it affected you, Josh?
Well, I was just going to say, it takes me to the other comment that I made about how getting over the food issue would somehow be like catastrophic to the parent. Is that possible too?
What do you mean?
You know, in other words, if we're eating, like in your previous example, if the person's eating to fill a void with the parent or to engage in that relationship, if she were to become cured, it would maybe for her it would be devastation, because then it's almost as if the relationship no longer exists. And for a child who no longer has a relationship with their mother, it's a very scary situation.
Well, the point would be that treatment would address the thoughts and feelings about the attachment issues that caused her to use food symbolically in this way. So that when you talk about cured, I think healed is a better way to put it. That when we are healed, we're able to relinquish those food behaviors and not feel things as acutely, because we're healed. We're not an open wound still dealing with the pain of our past or present or both relationships that are unresolved.
Right. And so we wouldn't have any fear of being healed as some sort of attack on that parent. I know this sounds crazy to someone.
No, nothing's not. You're talking to a psychoanalyst. Nothing is crazy.
Well, of course, but yeah. I know other people might be listening. So.
Well, let's just make this a little more specific, because I can't really talk about like the idea as a theory, because it's so amorphous. But is this a fear you have towards one of your parents?
Well, so that's what I'm trying to get at. I mean, I'm not really aware of anything, but I would say that it's possible, it's possible that the cure, or like you said, being healed, is also quite scary.
What's scary to you?
Well, nothing's really scary to me. I feel like in talking to you, I feel a lot better already. But I mean, I'm just saying that I think that, gosh, you know, if if we attached our sense of ourselves to our weight for a parent or something like that, then if we no longer have the weight problem, does the parent disappear in our mind? Do they die? You know?
Oh, I see. Psychologically. Yeah. Well, that's why sometimes it's hard to give up that inner critic, because that inner critic is often the voice of a parent. Not always. There are different reasons we create an inner critic, but often that is the voice of one of our parents. So there are, if we're talking about like fathers, there are two fathers. You have two fathers, Josh. You have the father who actually lives in wherever it is that you live or wherever he lives. And then there's the father you've internalized, the one in your mind. And that's why I say that the work I do is something of a psychological exorcism. We've got to like get that critical parent out of our minds. Let me give you an example. Is that also like, what are you talking about? Let me give you an example. You might've heard this, Josh, but other people may not have. Some years ago, I was at the park with my daughter, and there were these two little babies, like toddlers, playing in the sand, little boy, little girl, and they're just playing happily, just having a great time. And all of a sudden, the little boy got up and ran off with the shovel. So the little girl naturally starts crying. Hey, the little dude left her, took her shovel. Of course she's crying. And her mom comes running up. Don't cry. Don't cry. Don't cry. Oh my God, don't cry. Like panicking. And the little girl is crying. And the mom's like, don't cry, don't cry. It's okay. It's okay. And pulls out from the diaper bag a cookie. And she says, don't cry. Here, have a cookie. And I was just like, I want to say something so badly. That little girl would internalize her mother's way of relating to her. And one day she would become an adult woman who wanted to cry and would say to herself, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, have a cookie. And then that way we internalize the messages and the relationships that we are given. And the idea is to detach from them, which can feel like a loss. Absolutely. It can feel like you're killing off your parent in you psychologically. This is all not logical. This is psychological, right?
Yeah. And I would just take that one step further and say the healing almost becomes an impasse.
Sorry, I'm getting, for some reason, I'm getting a call. I can't turn it off. Oh, I'm sorry, you guys. Okay, it's off. I'm here.
That's okay. Okay, so I was just going to say that it's like if you were to take my father, for example, who I might be sort of eating to have a relationship with, if I were to somehow get better, it's not just, oh, the critic is gone. It's like I've lost my father in a very scary, real way that a child would look at losing a parent at that age. So it's sort of way, way more serious than what it sounded like you were saying.
I was using an example to show how we internalize our parents, right? You're talking about if you were to cast that inner father out, that you would be left bereft. Yes.
Not just bereft, like in danger, like endangered.
Of
loss of one's own life. In other words, so if I were to cast out my father's critical voice, like you're saying, I would feel as if I would feel the feeling would be as if I was myself about to die because my father now is sort of dead. Like it would be very, very intense.
So I would suggest to you that you have a very early trauma, a trauma that goes back really far to when you were so young that your very survival was predicated on your parents being there, and that there's some very painful experience that you need to heal. father. You think it's the opposite. You think you cast the father out and then go, oh my God, I've killed my father in my head and I can't survive this. But it's actually not, doesn't work like that. It's you resolve the early trauma, you resolve the relationships, you heal yourself, and then you can just release that internalized parent or internalized critic, however you want to put it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'll also with, yeah, I think that's correct. It's, you know, in the unconscious, things are very like contradictory. We might desire a parent, and at the same time, we might want to hate a parent or kill a parent, like in the Oedipus, you know, scenario. And then at the same time, we would sacrifice our lives to save a parent. All of these things are going on. They're all, they seem contradictory.
Yes. I can tell you've been doing a lot of reading of early psychoanalytic writers. but I urge you to stay with you, with the part of you that, that has that conflict and that fear, and to really heal the part of you that felt so perhaps abandoned. Because sometimes the thing we're afraid of is the thing we have already experienced. So if you're afraid of abandoning, being abandoned, maybe you felt abandoned, and that needs to be, you know, processed, worked through.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, that you just made about having already experienced these things. And I would just say to you is, and I don't know psychoanalysis, you know, but I would say that is it ambivalence when we both hate and desire the same parent?
It is that you have two opposing wishes or feelings towards the same person or thing. It's one person said of it, it's like being in a river where one current is going one way and the other half of the river is going the other way. Conflict is when we feel two opposite ways about the same thing. And the idea is to be able to hold them both. Hold the love with the hate. Hold the wish with the fear, and work through it and process it, because underlying all issues with food is some kind of internal conflict, some wish fear dilemma, and identifying and working through it is vital.
Yeah. So it would be a love and hate with food, and then maybe the love and hate behind to be able to hold these absolutely conflicting feelings of desire. And then also, like I was saying, you desire, say, parent X, and then you would also be willing to sacrifice your own being or body to save parent X. In other words, did I say that wrong? So you want to kill parent X, but at the same time, you want to kill yourself for parent X. Or whatever.
Those are conflicts. So exactly. And to be able to hold that conflict, process it, work through the wishes and the fears, so that they don't get played out with food. That's the goal.
Okay. So that really makes a lot of sense. And obviously there's emotion. This is all emotional work, right?
The idea of you know, separation is a thought, but with the idea of separation can come fear or hope or whatever it is. So there's always thoughts do not exist separate from an emotional reaction. That's why it's not logical, it's psychological. We can't positive think things away. We can't just drop something. We can't be logical. We've got to address the psychological parts of ourselves.
Okay, so that really makes a lot of sense. And then the emotions would fuel the food behaviors.
Thoughts and beliefs and ideas create feelings, which create behavior. So when in helping people change their relationship with food, if you just look at the behavior, nothing is ever going to change for good. Like you can go on a diet, you can go on a meal plan, you can join, you know, OA, you could do all kinds of things to address the behavior, but that's like plucking a weed and hoping it does not grow back. To really get rid of the root issues that lead to the behavior, you've got to do two things. One is change your thinking, because thoughts lead to feelings, lead to behavior, and also find new ways of coping with emotions other than eating over them. So when you change, right. When we change our minds, when we change the way we think, when we change what we believe, we change how we feel. When we change how we feel, we change our behavior. Of course, we can't escape feeling, you know, bad in the world, especially now, a lot to feel bad about, but we have to, you know, globally and of course personally, and then finding new strategies to self-soothe without food. Food is a way of, it does a lot of things, but one of the things it does is it provides a soothing and dissociating function. When you find new ways of soothing yourself, you don't use food for that purpose.
And I would just finish by saying, like, or follow up by saying that we can be okay with being healed.
Absolutely. Good is good. And, you know, when you say that, it references something I'm about to talk about, which is fear of happiness.
Yeah, so I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thank you for your always very interesting points. It's good to hear from you, Josh.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'll see you next.
Okay. All right. So is that about happiness or yes. Okay. So this is also still from the book. This is about Greg. He owned a successful contracting business. He built expensive homes in the most coveted neighborhoods of Los Angeles. His marriage was strong. His three kids were doing well in school. They were socially adjusted. Everything was going well. Yet the more successful he became, the more Greg focused on his quote unquote problem with food. That's what he came in to talk about. I have a problem with food. Help me with my food problem. When he landed a huge contract for a Bel Air estate, his thoughts soon turned to his inability to control his $1 million house or whatever it was at that time. It's probably like a $30 million house now. And then it's like, oh, I can't control my weight. He responded to all positive events in his life by bemoaning his weight and his helplessness over food, especially pasta. His maternal grandmother was Italian, and she made homemade pasta every Friday night. He recalled going to a friend's house for a sleepover as a child, where he was served, to his horror, spaghetti with ketchup. Sorry, I'm having my own memories of spaghetti with ketchup as a child. The memory of this dinner made him visibly shudder, and he was still aghast by thinking about it. He realized how lucky he was to have his cook, which then took on more significance and pleasure. Greg recalled an idyllic childhood, one he described as absolutely perfect. Until he was 10 years old, when everything changed in what seemed like an instant. One moment, life was good. He was celebrating the fact that his soccer team had won a match. The next moment, or so it seemed, his parents were sitting him down with sober expressions and announcing their plans to divorce. Greg's life turned upside down in that instant. Greg felt himself suddenly and unwillingly cast from his perfect life. Greg was an active child and played sports throughout childhood and into college. He married his college girlfriend, and they had a loving, strong relationship. His wife stayed at home and raised their boys while he built a lucrative business. He hired his father, who was also a contractor, but who had never achieved Greg's level of success. When Greg's oldest son was 10 years old, Greg began overeating on a regular basis. He developed a habit of ordering pasta for lunch along with bread and dessert, and he gained weight for the first time in his life. He described feeling like an addict and couldn't stop thinking about eating Italian food. He quickly gained 30 pounds and was unable to lose it. Greg was more financially successful than his father, yet the weight gain did not appear to be related to, this is for you, Josh, Oedipal guilt, meaning feeling guilty for outdoing his father. Greg started gaining weight when his son was 10 years old, the same age that Greg had been when his parents announced their divorce. As a result of that seminal incident, he unconsciously developed a belief that happiness and success invariably lead to loss. When his son reached the age of 10, repressed fears of being cast from paradise were reactivated during what might be thought of as an anniversary effect. His son was 10. It brought Greg back to when he was 10 and his whole world fell apart. Greg began fearing that things were too good to be true. It can't last. One way of ensuring that he never felt too happy, as he put it, was to always be upset about his weight. As we worked through this underlying belief, Greg slowly began feeling more secure about his situation, and his fixation for Italian food, which he associated with childhood evenings with his Italian grandmother, slowly abated. He was eventually able to reach a healthy weight, and his relationship with food normalized. In this situation with Greg, the unresolved feelings from when he was 10, the idea that life can change in a minute and that if you are too happy, that the other shoe is going to drop, the rug's going to be pulled out from underneath you. Look at how many ways our culture tells us not to be too happy. Well, one way that we can avoid feeling too good, and I say too with like imaginary quotes around it, is to never feel too good. You can't feel too good if you're always a little bit upset about your weight. And that is why fear of happiness is actually one of the bigger motivators for being unable to reach a goal, including fitness or weight loss, or even to stop binging. There's the idea that, something really bad is going to happen. So that is something to definitely keep in mind. So let me just continue with what a little bit of what I wrote about food addiction in the book, because I think it's pertinent. Although there is little scientific basis for the idea of food addiction, many people are addicted to using food to alleviate distress or to express unconscious or conscious conflict. Now that, I would say, would be an eating addiction. I really hate the word addiction. I find it very shaming, even though the book is called Beyond the Primal Addiction. Personally, I'm not a fan of the word addiction. But if we're going to use the word addiction as it pertains to food, let's say it is an eating addiction, with a behaving something internal. I have found that most of the people that, if not all of the people that I treat, and I treat people all over the world, all genders, all backgrounds, very, very different, but they all have one thing in common. They lack a way of self-soothing or comforting themselves, and they have little ability to reflect about why they're eating. They're focusing on what they're eating. They're not looking at what's eating at them. Also, when there is a fundamental distrust in relationships, it's often difficult to trust that other people will be interested, attuned, responsive to you. And that's why it's easier to turn to food than to people. People can be unreliable, unpredictable, unavailable. Food is reliable, predictable, and available. So since food also represents mothering and nurturing, when we're upset, it's easier to turn to food than to people. if that's your relationship with, you know, the world. So a critical aspect of, you know, what I help people with is focusing on finding meaning in the experience rather than trying to change the behavior. I hear from people who say, you know, like they had therapists who tried to get them to eat differently. You know what happens? That always backfires. That puts you in a power struggle. You will lose. I mean, I'm talking about the therapist. The therapist tries to get someone to eat differently. Eventually, they will lose that dynamic because even if the person originally is like, oh, yes, I'll eat differently. No, in time, it doesn't change anything. And they're just eating differently to please the therapist or something. So I think it's important to look at what, if you consider yourself a food addict, look at food as a frenemy. It is a friend in that it is doing something for you. It is helping you in some way. It is helping you cope. It is helping you dissociate. It is filling a void. It is turning emotional pain to physical pain. If you've ever eaten so much that it hurts and you do not understand why you can't stop eating when you're in actual physical pain and you can't stop and you think, what's wrong with me? What is my problem? Well, ask yourself a different question. What pain is this expressing? If you are turning to food to resolve something emotional or some emotional conflict, there is always a reason. And it may seem as if, you know, we're like triggered by food. Everyone thinks they're triggered by food. They think they're triggered by ice cream or chocolate or pasta or whatever. They think they're triggered by food. But I am here to tell you, no, we are not triggered by food. We are triggered by a situation or an emotion or a conflict or something internal that we can't see or maybe don't want to look at. But when we are able to see why we're turning to food instead of focusing on what we're eating, and when we accept ourselves and work through those emotional conflicts from the past and the present, then we are free of binge eating for good. And also a very important part of that, when we are nice to ourselves, when we learn to soothe ourselves with words. If a friend of yours was upset and you know, you wanted to help them out, you wouldn't say, okay, you're upset. All right, I know just what to do. Look, ice cream's in the freezer. The chips are in the pantry. Let's order pizza. Never, 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 never. You would be helpful, you would be interested, you would be supportive. And the goal is to be that to ourselves, to learn to respond to ourselves with words. When we do that, when we're kind to ourselves, when we are loving to ourselves and accepting of ourselves, we stop using food to cope. So it is not about food addiction. It is about a way of coping that uses food. But it also hurts us as well as helps us. If it didn't help us, we wouldn't be doing it. And there are so many reasons why it is easier to focus on food than it is, or our weight or whatever, than it is to focus on what's eating at us. Often people realize, oh, if I were not thinking about my weight, what's weighing on me? I'm not happy in my relationship, or I don't think I'm happy in my career, or my kids who I love are driving me crazy, or I, you know, I don't know if I want to still do something. I've been like, you know, you get the idea. I don't know if I still want to do this thing that I've been doing, and maybe I want to change my life, but oh no, that's too scary to look at. So, oh my God, look at the number on the scale. Oh. It's easier to count calories and macros and carbs on you internally. It is easier to do that. It's, you know, it's hard to look inward. It's hard to see inside our souls, our minds, our fears, our conflicts, our wishes. It's hard to do that. But ultimately, it's the thing that brings us total liberation, right? Thoughts lead to feelings, lead to behavior. You focus on the behavior, you're going to be on this cycle forever, forever. But when you change your relationship with yourself, when you identify why you're eating instead of focusing on what you're eating, and when you heal, then you change everything for good. That's what I call liberation. Right? Liberation means weight, body image. Liberation means you have won that war. You are no longer battling yourself. You are no longer constantly hating yourself, fighting your own body. Liberation means you're at peace. You can wake up and think about your day, not your diet. You don't think about food every minute of the day. You just think about it when it's like lunchtime or you're hungry. And you stay out of the kitchen at night, no problem, because you don't need to go in there. Because you can be there for yourself and with yourself. And it means not judging ourselves and accepting ourselves, our perfectly imperfect selves. This is the key to liberation from binge eating or anything else that you're doing that you don't want to do. If you're doing something you don't want to do, or you're not doing something you want to do, there is always, I know I only have a few minutes, but related to fears that happiness would lead to something catastrophic. So, you know, with Greg, as long as he was not happy with his weight, he was safe. Willow had the pretty face syndrome. You know, her grandmother would tell her she had such a pretty face, and if she would just lose weight, men would be lined up around the block trying to date her. Oh, you're welcome, Carly Gash. So really briefly, Willow thought she couldn't date until she lost weight. When she lost weight, then the men would be lined up around the block, right? But she never lost weight. She just couldn't lose weight. And even though people would say to her, like, you don't need to lose weight, there are plenty of guys out there who'd be into you as you are. Like, lots of guys, you know, bigger women or plus size or whatever, however you want to put it. But she said, no. I have to be thin. So why did she say that? Well, she had grown up watching her mother submit to her stepfather on every aspect of their life. Her stepfather decided what programs to watch on TV, where to visit on vacation, what to have for dinner. Her mother was powerless to make even the most basic household decisions and had to justify all her purchases, even the type of dishwashing detergent she bought, to her husband. So Willow developed the idea that marriage and relationship meant being subsumed by the needs and wishes of the other person. And as long as she remained heavy, her weight protected her from the kind of male attention that would lead to dating, which would lead to a relationship, which would lead to her losing herself. So in that way, you know, staying heavier was her way of protecting herself. And once she realized that this wasn't a conscious idea, but it was, you know, it was unconscious. And once we brought it into conscious awareness and challenged it, she was able to lose weight and find a nice guy who wasn't a control freak. And, you know, they're living happily ever after. Yay. So there's always a reason, right? And to be curious about that reason. And when you are curious, you're able to find answers. That is the show for today. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio, also live streaming on Instagram. I'm here every Wednesday live at 11 a.m. Pacific. You can also watch later on Apple Podcasts. Just look for the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts. And if you like this show, it would mean so much to me and I would appreciate it so much. Thank you. Thank you. Take good care. Stay curious, not critical. I'll see you next week. Bye.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.